Thanks very much. It's actually going to be a very specialized course in terms of Carleman estimates, but you'll see. Yeah, so I'd like to thank Adrian and Slava for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's also a very good time for having a kind of program on geometry in inverse problems. And there has been lots of activity recently in the interplay between ideas from inverse problems coming from applications and analysis PDE on one hand and geometry on the other hand. And there has been progress in recent years, but there's lots of interesting open questions, as hopefully you'll also see during this course. So I hope that we'll be able to make more progress during this program. Yeah, so really, the title is Carleman Estimates. And anisotropic inverse problems. I guess this is a slight overstatement because I'm mostly going to talk about one anisotropic inverse problem, which is the Calderon problem and its variants. So what I'm going to talk about also involves another problem, which is the inversion of the geodesic X-ray transform. But I mean, this course by Gabriel Paternain, the same week we'll discuss these topics or some aspects of it. So I'm only going to touch that very briefly, and I'll leave the rest to Gabriel. And so I'm going to actually follow a course which I've given twice before, once in Helsinki and once in Madrid. And there's lecture notes available for this course. You'll find them on my webpage. I'll also circulate it now. So for much of this course, yeah, you don't need to take notes if you want. But yeah, that's fine. There's actually two versions which are both on my webpage. Yeah, there's one copy. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So there's this will be published in the proceedings of the Inside Out, this MSRI program in inverse problems. And that's the slightly more updated version. You'll find it on the web page. But I think in the end of the course, if there's time, I'm going to discuss something which is not published yet.
And not
no. Okay. So okay, I should say that so I personally am an analyst by training, and this will probably be visible in the lectures, but I'll try to present things in a way so that also geometers would be able to appreciate it. Okay, so let's start with discussing the questions we are going to talk about in this course. And so as I mentioned, there will mostly be variants of the Calderon problem. So this is, I guess, one of the most famous inverse problems, where the idea is that you want to make images of a medium by some electrical measurements on the boundary. For instance, in medical imaging, you might want to, let's say, find breast cancer by putting electrodes on the patient or on the part which you want to image, and then putting in some small voltages and then measuring the outgoing currents at the boundary. So you're making non-invasive measurements. You are only measuring at the boundary, but you try to find out what is inside. And so mathematically, you would consider some electricity conducting medium, which I call omega. So it's a bounded domain in Rn with smooth boundary. Okay. And okay, so I've received some complaints about my handwriting, so I'll try to use a different typeface. Hopefully I'll succeed. Okay, and so this is a medium which conducts electricity, so it has some conductivity, which I'm going to take to be a matrix. This is symmetric positive definite matrix. And I'm assuming that all of the entries are smooth up to the boundary. So, right. And you assume that you attach these electrodes on the boundary, and then you put in some small voltages, and then they will induce voltage potential inside your medium, and under some assumptions, the potential U inside the medium will satisfy what is called the conductivity equation. So it's the second order elliptic equation. Divergence of gamma gradient U is 0 in omega. And then if you prescribe a boundary voltage F, then your U will solve the Dirichlet problem for the conductivity equation. Yeah, sure. And so the measurements you are going to make is the outgoing current flux. Which is basically going to be the normal derivative of your solution. I'm going to write it in this way. So it's gamma gradient U dot nu. Or nu is the unit autonormal vector of your domain. So I'm going to encode these boundary measurements as a map, which is called the Dirichlet to Neumann map, which takes the Dirichlet data of the solution or the voltage which you prescribe at the boundary into the measured outgoing current flux at the boundary. So I'm going to call this thing the Dirichlet to Neumann map, or DN map. And then the idea is that you prescribe many different voltages F at the boundary, and then you measure all the corresponding currents, and from measurements like this, you would like to determine this conductivity matrix, or as much of it as you would expect in the interior. So in this way, from the measurements encoded by this map, which acts on functions on the boundary and gives out functions at the boundary, you would like to recover gamma. So this is the Calderon problem. As I said, it has been suggested as a procedure in medical imaging and also seismic imaging, but the problem is it's a very ill-posed problem, so it's difficult to actually make it work in practice. But I guess at least I think of it as a kind of a nice model inverse problem for an elliptic equation. And the idea is, if you understand the Calderon problem, then you will understand lots of other problems which can be modeled by elliptic equations, like, for instance, this problem is related to inverse scattering problems. It's related to inverse problems for the Maxwell equations, and there's recently been a lot of interest in invisibility, which is somehow trying to hide things inside so that you would not be able to discover them by boundary measurements. So the Calderon problem is very much related to that. And it's also related to geometric problems, like there's a connection between this problem and what is called the boundary rigidity problem, which was discussed last week here by I guess, Burago and Ivanov. And it also comes up in other applied contexts, like nowadays there has been interest in hybrid imaging methods where you try to combine different physical modalities to produce better pictures. And some of the analysis of the Calderon problem actually turns out very useful in these hybrid imaging methods. So it's a very fundamental problem. So So I'm going to state my first question here. And this is what I call the anisotropic Calderon problem. So you let gamma 1 and gamma 2 be two positive definite symmetric matrices. And so this is kind of asking for the uniqueness in the Calderon form. So if you have two conductivity coefficients for which all the boundary measurements coincide, so the idea is that you would be able to recover this conductivity coefficient from this boundary measurement. So then you would want to conclude that gamma 1 is equal to gamma 2. Turns out that when the conductivity when the conductivities are matrices, there's actually no obstruction to uniqueness. So I'll describe this now. So lambda 1 is equal to lambda gamma 2, then gamma 1 and gamma 2 are the same up to a change of coordinate. For some diffeomorphism or a change of coordinates f, and mapping omega bar onto omega bar. So this would be a diffeomorphism in the interior which extends smoothly up to the boundary and it respects the boundary points. So the idea is that somehow this diffeomorphism F, it fixes every boundary point, but in the inside it can move things around. And then this is the kind of non-uniqueness which you have in this problem. So let me just explain a little bit more precisely what this means. So this is kind of an obstruction to uniqueness. Yes, sure. So this obstruction to uniqueness in this case would be so if F is a diffeomorphism with which keeps the boundary fixed, so then always lambda F lower star gamma is equal to lambda gamma, where so this is now going to be the push forward of a tensor, so it's defined in this way. Okay, at some point x tilde, and this would be, so you have the Jacobian matrix of F. Then you have the matrix gamma, so this is just matrix multiplication. And then you should have the transpose divided by the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian, and at the point x tilde is x is f minus 1 of x tilde. So the idea somehow is that this second order elliptic equation, conductivity equation, has a certain behavior under changes of coordinates. And this is just encoding that when you change coordinates by the map F, and then when you change the conductivity gamma to be the push forward, so then you are preserving the boundary measurements. And the proof is actually very easy. So if U solves the original conductivity equation, so then this function u tilde, so solves the conductivity equation with the push forward conductivity. Okay. So the conjecture is that this is the only obstruction to uniqueness. So somehow you, from the boundary measurements for a matrix conductivity, you would be able to recover kind of a distorted image of your original conductivity, which means image up to some change of coordinates. Okay. So in two dimensions, this is a theorem by Adrian Nachman. And the idea is that, so there's some terminology which I should mention. So here, so if gamma of x is equal to a multiple of the identity matrix, or C is some scalar function, so then gamma is called isotropic and otherwise it's anisotropic. So in the isotropic case where your conductivity matrix is actually just a scalar function, then the properties of the electrical current do not depend on the direction. So all of the directions are the same. Whereas in the anisotropic case, the electrical current will move differently in different directions. And this is, of course, a practical. In practice, you will have lots of anisotropic conductor. For instance, muscle tissue, for instance, heart muscle, has this kind of fiber structure. So you know that electricity goes along the fibers in a different way than in the transverse directions. And there's actually a lot known about this, the Calderon form in the isotropic case. So when Adrian proved, I think in 1996, that in two dimensions you can recover an isotropic conductivity from the Dirichlet-Neumann map. So it turns out that in two dimensions there's a way of going from the anisotropic or the matrix case into the isotropic case, and this is based on the isothermal coordinates. So the idea is that in two dimensions there's a special choice of coordinates called isothermal coordinates, which allow you to convert any elliptic equation with a matrix coefficient into an elliptic equation with a scalar coefficient. So this is also somehow due to the fact that all two-dimensional manifolds are locally conformally trivial. In three and high dimensions, this is not the case, and this question is open in three and higher dimensions. So this is kind of the first major question. And let me now try to make this a bit more geometric. So instead of asking this question in Rn, let me ask a similar question on a manifold. So now going to take Mg, be a compact Riemannian manifold. With smooth boundary. And I'm going to formulate a similar problem for in this setting. So D is now a Riemannian metric, so it's kind of, in local coordinates, it's just a symmetric positive definite matrix, like your conductivity coefficient there, so somehow they look very similar. And on a Riemannian manifold, this conductivity equation is replaced by the Laplace-Beltram equation. So there's on any Riemannian manifold, there's a canonical second-order elliptic operator. The Laplace-Beltrami operator, it's called lambda t, so, or t and in local coordinates it's going to look like this. So you have, so this will be the determinant of the metric in some local coordinates. So where G is given by the matrix GJK in local coordinates, and this G upper JK, as is usual, is the inverse matrix of G lower JK, and this thing is the determinant of GJK. Okay. So formally, this operator here is basically the same as the one I'm having here. So you just replace the matrix gamma by a determinant of G to the 1/2 times the inverse matrix of G. So then I want to set up a similar inverse problem as I had here. So I'm going to set up the Dirichlet-Neumann map. So the Dirichlet problem will of course be for the Laplace-Beltram equation. This is saying that you're looking at the solution of the Laplace-Beltram equation in M with a fixed boundary value. So basically you're just looking for a harmonic function in this Riemannian manifold with a given boundary value, and then the boundary measurements will be given by the Dirichlet-Neumann map. Which in this case takes the boundary value f into the Neumann data, which is going to be the normal derivative of the solution u at the boundary. Now I'm taking the normal derivative in terms of the Riemannian metric, so this will be in local coordinate g upper jk dju nu k dm, where again nu is going to be the unit outer normal, or the unit outer one form for your Riemannian manifold with boundaries. Okay, so far this is looking very analogous, and also in this case there's going to be an obstruction to uniqueness, and the geometer would see this immediately because you know that this operator here is invariant under change of coordinates. So basically if you change coordinates, then you're not changing the equation. And but the matrix here is a little bit different than the one over there, so the non-uniqueness will come up in the form of a pullback. So if is a diffeomorphism of your manifold, it's smooth up to the boundary and fixes every boundary point. So then you are not changing the boundary measurements if you replace the metric T by the pullback by this diffeomorphism. So this is the usual pullback in local coordinates. It has the form, and I guess now you are going to need the Jacobian matrix. So which way does the transpose go? This is transposed. You have G at f of x as a matrix. And again, this capital DF is the Jacobian matrix of the map F. So now your question will be, So question two, which I'm also going to call the anisotropic Calderon problem. It could also be the Calderon problem on a manifold. So let MG1 and MG2 be two compact Riemannian manifolds. With boundary and I'm going to assume that n, which is the dimension of the manifold, is bigger than or equal to 3. And the question is, if these two manifolds have the same Dirichlet to Neumann maps, then show that G2 and G1 are related by some change of coordinates. Which fixes every boundary point.
Yeah.
No, I don't. So it would be... Okay, so another way of thinking about this problem is in geometric terms. So you're looking at basically harmonic functions in your manifold MG, and then the fact that the Dirichlet Neumann maps or these boundary measurements are the same means that the harmonic functions in your two manifolds MG1 and MG2 have the exact same Cauchy data on the boundary. So both the Dirichlet and the Neumann values are the same at the boundary. And so this, I guess, of course, means that the metrics G1 and G2 are isometric, or the manifolds are isometric. So really what this question is asking is that do the Cauchy data of all harmonic functions on a Riemannian manifold boundary determine the manifold up to isometry? So somehow a nicer way to state this would be to have two different sets, M1 G1 and M2 G2. And somehow ask which have somehow a diffeomorphic boundary, and say that if the Cauchy data of harmonic functions are the same, so then you would recover the isometric class of the manifold. So it's a very somehow nice question also in this geometric setting. So let me just say a few things. So a positive answer question 2 would imply a positive answer to question 1. If the dimension is bigger than or equal to 3. And this follows just by taking gamma jk equal to g to the 1/2 g upper jk. So this is the way how you go from this to the earlier question. And a small remark, I'm making this restriction dimension bigger than or equal to 3 here, and the reason is that in dimension 2 the Laplace-Beltrami operator has an additional invariance. It has a conformal invariance which the conductivity equation does not have. So the two-dimensional version of this question should look a little bit different. But also in this case, the two-dimensional question is known to be true. It's a result by Lasses and Ullmann. And somehow again boils down to isothermal coordinates. And in dimensions 3 and higher it's open. So the results that are known are, if the manifolds are real analytic, so then a positive answer is known. It's a result of Lee and Ullmann with some topological assumptions which were later removed by other people. And the idea is that if your metric is real analytic, then you know that somehow the Taylor series of the metric at the point determines it everywhere. And so there are ways of of getting your hands on the Taylor series of the metric at the boundary if you know the Dirichlet Neumann. So this is somehow an easier question, determine things at the boundary if you know the boundary measurements. And then if it's real analytic, then you can somehow extend. It's still a non-trivial result because you already cover the Taylor series near a fixed boundary point in a certain system of local coordinates, and then somehow you need to extend it to the whole manifold. So it's non-trivial, but still, it's really based on the fact that you are only seeing things at the boundary. And it's also known for Einstein manifolds. This is a result by Colin-Guillermo and Sabarreto. And the idea is that Einstein manifolds are, they're actually real analytic in the interior if you look at them in the right local coordinates, which is the harmonic coordinates. So it's still very close to being real analytic. But the conjecture is that this should be true for any smooth manifold. And in this course, I'm going to tell you what is known in the case when you just assume that the metrics are smooth. Okay. So these are two big questions. And let me go on and state a few more. So I'm going to make this question a little bit simpler. And the way I'm going to make is I'm going to restrict these two Riemannian metrics to be in the same conformal class. So what this means that in the same conformal class. So this means that one of them is a scalar multiple of the other one. So where C is a scalar. So now there's basically only one underlying Riemannian metric. So it's this T1, and then the other one is a scalar multiple of G1. And then and then it turns out that there's no deep homomorphism invariant, so this condition goes away. And the reason is that any diffeomorphism F with which fixes every boundary point and somehow maybe I should. Okay. So G2 is CG1. F star G1 is CG1. And satisfies. It must be the identity map. So this is a fact. I don't have a good reference for it. I don't know if any of you knows. So somehow, the fact that it's this means that it's a conformal transformation of the manifold MG1. So it means that F has to satisfy some PDE, the conformal PDE, and additionally its identity at the boundary. That gives so many constraints that it has to be identity everywhere. And so in this case, the question would be, So basically the following. So let mg1 and mg2 be compact Riemannian manifolds. With smooth boundary in the same conformal class. And also assume that n is bigger than or equal to 3. So then if the boundary measurements for these two metrics, which are now just scalar multiples of each other, are the same, then the question is to show that. G1 is equal to G2. There's no diffeomorphism invariance in this case. So this is an easier problem, and it's also true that a positive answer to question 2 would imply a positive answer to question 3. Just by the fact that if, when the boundary measurements are the same, so then the positive answer to question 2 is saying that G1 and G2 are the same after a diffeomorphism, but additionally you know that these two are in the same conformal class, so the diffeomorphism has to be the identity. So, but this is also open. But now we are getting close to some results where actually some things are known. So I'm going to state a final question, question 4, which is a little bit stronger than this one, but which can be analyzed, and question 4 is what the rest of this course is basically going to be devoted to. So So this idea is based on the fact that the Laplace-Beltrami operator has a certain transformation law under conformal scalings of the metric. So this is saying that the Laplacian of CG of a function U is equal to, I think, now I probably have to, I need to check the exponents. This will be minus n plus 2 over 4 Laplacian of G plus a zeroed term, c to the n minus 2 over 3 u, where this q is just a function, it's c n minus 2 over 4, Laplacian of c g, c to the minus n minus 2 over 4. Okay. So this is somehow related to the fact that there exists an operator called a conformal Laplacian on a manifold. So it's just a Laplace-Beltrami operator, and you subtract off a multiple of the scalar curvature. And you know that that thing has a nice scaling law under conformal transformation. So there's no zero, and you just have these multiples here. And also if n is equal to 2, then you see that this thing will be 1 and the Laplacian will be 0. So then Q is equal to 0. So actually the conformal multiple just comes out in two dimensions as you would expect. So that's the difference between 2D and 3 and higher dimensions. Okay, so in this way I can somehow get rid of the scalar multiple here at the expense of introducing a zero dependent equation. So I'm going to consider inverse form for a Schrödinger equation. So this Schrödinger operator on the manifold is something like this, where V is, let's say, it's a L infinity function. So I'm just going to look at the same kind of Dirichlet problem as before. So I'm solving this elliptic equation with the given Dirichlet boundary value. And now, depending on your potential V, you actually might hit an eigenvalue. So it might be that this Dirichlet problem is not uniquely solvable. For instance, if V is minus an eigenvalue, so then you know that there exists non-trivial solutions with zero boundary values. These are the Dirichlet eigenfunctions. So I'm going to make the standing assumption that I never hit an eigenvalue. It would be easy to avoid this assumption by considering what is called the Cauchy data set. It's a different way of giving you boundary measurements than the Dirichlet Neumann. But just for simplicity, I'm assuming that zero is not a Dirichlet eigenvalue. For the Schrödinger operator. So this means that for any nice Dirichlet data here, this problem has a unique solution. And then the boundary measurements are given by the Dirichlet Neumann map, lambda GV, which takes F again to the Riemannian normal derivative of your solution here. And then the question four will be, it will be basically uniqueness in the inverse form for the Schrödinger equation on a Riemannian manifold with boundary. So if MG is a compact Riemannian manifold with smooth boundary, and if V1 and V2 are two, I'm going to call these potentials. So then, if you know that these two potentials will give you the same boundary measurements, so then the potentials would have to be the same. So it's true that a positive answer to question 4 implies positive answer to question 3. And it really boils down to the fact that the Laplace-Beltrami operator has this behavior under conformal scaling. So you also know that if your conformal factor is such that it's one at the boundary and the normal derivative at the boundary is zero, so somehow your conformal scaling respects the boundary values, so then the boundary measurements for the metric CG and no potential are exactly the same as the boundary measurements for G and the potential minus Q, where Q is this function here depending on the conformal factor. So this is an easy exercise to check by using this conformal scaling law. So this means that if you are in this setting, so then you can, because one of the metrics is a multiple of the other, then you can go to replace this Dirichlet Neumann map by the Dirichlet Neumann for the Schrödinger equation, and then you have, this is going to be equal to lambda g zero for the Dirichlet Neumann for the zero potential, and if this has a positive answer, then your q is equal to zero, and then you just look at q here, and this will imply that because your c here satisfies some boundary conditions, then this will imply that c is actually identically equal to one. Okay. So this is the question which I'm going to concentrate on in this course. So how am I doing time-wise? So I guess I had 90 minutes. So I probably won't be able to talk all that time. So right. Or then end a little bit earlier. Is there some preference in terms of lunch or? Yeah. Okay. So maybe let's have a 10-minute break now and then continue. Yeah.
That condition is probably not necessary.
No, it has to.
You somehow know C on the boundary from the singularities, right?
No, I'm just saying that
becomes, that becomes, of course, some sort of, it's not Dirichlet.
Yes.
So Neumann is third Robin.
Yeah, that's right. So if you don't have these conditions, yeah, then you will have multiples of C here, and then you will have...
Well, it will be some CDN plus C, plus
right.
Some N.
Yeah.
And then you don't really need to zero, because it satisfies this equation. Q is given and has a unique solution somehow.
Right.
So you find C anyway.
Yeah, but I guess, so what I just wrote down here is enough to reduce question 4, question 3 to question 4. But
if you know the C is 1. Actually, if you know C is 1, then you know. It's a priori you know, because it's...
Because of boundary determination, yeah, exactly.
But this you don't know.
That you also get from boundary determination.
Right. You know the complete set of
C. Yeah, and then you just compare, because you know that one of the metrics is a multiple of the other one. Which one?
Because you need a boundary for this, right? This is not true. It's no diffeomorphism invariant. It's not true if you don't have a boundary.
So you need to have this boundary condition here.
How do you know this thing, where it comes from?
So
it's a new theorem, I guess.
Yeah,
right.
In Rn, right?
Yeah, but when it's not.
Yeah, so the idea is somehow your F has to satisfy some PDE because it's a conformal transformation.
Yes.
So there's kind of a, I guess they call it a finite type condition. So it puts a lot of restrictions still on what F can look like.
Uh-huh.
So I guess you just look at the group of conformal transformations on a manifold and then some.